don't fully understand. Okay, so just as a sort of a preface to this, why this topic is interesting, I think, is because it indicates, and it allows us to go through a really, really dead simple thought experiment that uses super basic ideas about relativity, super basic ideas of quantum, and we put these together with a little bit of thought, and we come to a conclusion that will just totally blow your mind. Okay, and it's related to this thing called an information bound and holographic ideas and so on and so forth. And it's suggesting that whatever quantum gravity is, it might require us to think quite outside the box. So like Param was telling us yesterday at the keynote session, we're sitting here staring at the lake trying to figure out new ideas and so on and so forth. It just shows us why quantum gravity might be such a difficult topic, might be just such a difficult nut to crack, problem to solve, because it might require us to think in such completely radically new ways that might involve, in this particular instance, the idea that the universe might be holographic in nature in some way. So anyway, so what I'd like to do is I'd like to go through a bit of a PowerPoint presentation on this, which is a little bit of fun, and then we have Sean Gribb at the back, who is a graduate student here at Perimeter. Yeah, please. Yeah. And so he's a researcher here, and he's. I understand that. Did you start in string theory, and then you defected over to?
Yeah.
I
did not.
Okay. And then I switched. Okay. So you saw the light. I mean, you saw. The light. I guess. So. Do you want me to talk about that? Or?
Sure, why don't you talk about that for a little bit? I'll just shut off the lights here and get us sort of going here.
What?
Okay. Oh, if you want, if you don't want to.
But no, I started in string theory, which is, very interesting. Hey, have you guys heard of talk on string theory yet?
No. We are going to, Rob Myers is.
Oh, Rob's, yeah. Okay, Rob's my old supervisor. And so, ask him some tough questions, because, string theory is very interesting. And it's also a sort of suggestion for how to unify gravity of all of the forces. And it's very interesting, but I found that it's interesting in physics, often the culture and the field, people that surround you are just as important as that stuff you're actually working on. And so I found for myself, I realized at some point that I really don't deal very well with any type of authority or people telling me what I should be working on. And I found that I could have more freedom and calm down. So that's one cool thing about physics, is that I think it's maybe important to sort of pick something that suits your personality best. For me, it was calm down. So it's not a strike against string theory. It's just I like working on things that I like. Is that a good?
That's perfect. Thank you, Sean.
I don't know what you want me to say. There's nothing to do with actually, well. Did we get a break before?
Well, we sort of had a break at, when did we have a break? At 3:30?
3:30.
Yeah,
so we just had a little half hour. We tried to finish off some of the round two.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, so I'm hoping that I will just have maybe 15, 20 minutes for this PowerPoint. We'll just kind of zip through. It's kind of fun, and then Sean is an expert in this whole holographic idea, and so we'll open it up to questions, and we're gonna have a lot of fun. All right, so
where is this? Oh, wrong one. Okay, sorry. The world as a hologram. Okay. So the first question I want to ask here is, what do we know about our universe? Okay, well, that's kind of a silly question. Okay, we know a lot about our universe, right? But if we were to summarize that in two key words, what would those key words be? Big, that's good. Expanding, yeah. Branches of knowledge. Okay, so what I'm thinking of is two key words, relativity and quantum. OK, Okay, so quantum tells us basically how it is that atoms can exist. Okay, so I think that probably most of you have seen this modern kind of a picture of an atom, this sort of a thing. So quantum, it turns out, of course, that, and we'll be talking about this during the quantum lectures a bit more, but I'm sure that most of you are aware, and actually Parham pointed out yesterday, that atoms can't exist in a universe that's described by, that pre-quantum ideas. Okay? And so we needed quantum ideas to understand how atoms can exist. And relativity, sort of in a nutshell, tells us how gravity works. So Newton told us that gravity is a force, and he told us the strength of the force varies inversely like the distance squared, and so on and so forth. But the actual mechanism for what that is wasn't really clarified. Doesn't really tell us how gravity actually works, and that was left to general relativity. So for example, here there's a neutron star here, this is a black hole. This is a neutron star zipping around like this, and there's enormous tidal forces happening here, which are heating up this neutron star, and it's being pulled apart, and all of its guts are being spread out over here, and it's spiraling into the black hole like water down a drain. And when that energy goes in, when that matter goes in, a tremendous amount of heat is generated, and X-rays come flying off, and whatever. It's a super dynamic, super amazing process. The universe is way cool, and we wouldn't be able to understand stuff like this without general relativity. Okay, so how gravity works. So sort of in a nutshell, what we understand about the universe, all of 20th century physics, the two pillars of understanding were quantum and relativity. And now, of course, we're trying to bring those two closer together, working better with each other. Okay, so basically the problem is that quantum and relativity are incompatible with each other. Okay, so quantum is all about probability, okay, chance. Okay, the probability if this is set up like this, then at the end of the day that will happen. You know, so it's like roll of the dice. It's all about chance and likelihood of this or that happening. So like Parham, for example, yesterday showed us multiple paths. So a particle in getting from A to B can exist in this weird state in which it appears to be simultaneously in multiple paths with different probabilities and so on. So that's the kind of nature of quantum. It's all about probabilities. Whereas relativity, on the other hand, is very definite. I mean, it's very solid geometrical laws, which are completely predictable. Okay, so the orbits of planets and so on are determined by geometrical laws, and there's no uncertainty there. Okay, so they appear to be quite different in nature. They appear to be talking in different languages. Okay, so they're incompatible in that sense. Okay, so it's a little bit like a split personality here. Okay, and so we've got or like apples and oranges. And so we're trying to find some kind of way to bring these two fruits together. Okay, so ultimately what it is it's a question like, how is it possible for our universe to exist? Because on the one hand, we know for certain that the universe is relativistic. Okay, so as for example, Parham mentioned yesterday, the laws of both special and general relativity are well established experimentally. I mean, to the best of our current technology, they pass with flying colors, and the universe definitely appears to be relativistic. It's certainly not Newtonian. It's certainly not Newtonian kind of gravity. Okay, so so it's relativistic, but on the other hand, it's also certainly quantum. Okay, so there's no doubt that some stuff is going on in the atom that is not classical, that goes beyond our classical day-to-day understanding of the world. Okay, the trouble is that mathematically, at least, we don't have a theory that speaks one language that brings the two of them together, that has the two of them working together. Okay, and so I guess what I'm trying to say is that the universe exhibits this property and that property. We haven't understood how those properties can work together. So in other words, we don't understand how the universe can exist. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Okay, so basically we're trying to take these apples and oranges and create this thing, the apple orange. Okay, so your mission here over the next few minutes here. Dun, 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 dun. is twofold. One is to learn quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. Sound doable? Okay, excellent. And number two, guess what they are trying to tell us about the nature of our universe at the deepest possible level. Sound doable? Okay, excellent. Okay, so here we go. Step one, quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. So let's start with quantum. Okay, so basic thing is E equals HF. So I think all of you know that equation. So it has to do with photons. So in quantum, the idea, when you apply quantum ideas to light, you find out that light is composed of particles that we call photons, and these photons have an energy, E equals HF, where H is Planck's constant and F is the frequency. Okay, so that's a basic fact about the quantum nature of light. So here are positively charged ions and negatively charged electrons whipping around here like this. And so when they whip around, there's rapid acceleration. And during that acceleration, particles are emitted. Particles of light are emitted, which are the really cool little fiery particles zipping around here. I like those little things. It's so cool. I mean, this is, well, I don't know if that's exactly what it looks like, but it's kind of what it might look like. Okay, so relativity. E equals mc squared. Mass and energy are interchangeable. Mass and energy are, in essence, the same thing. And as we go through special relativity in a bit more detail, we'll understand that in a little bit of a deeper level. Okay, so that's basically it. So was that 60? Does anyone keep them track? 30 seconds. Whoa, this is super. Okay. Is that all totally clear? Okay, super. Let's move on. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. I had this cool animation here. So energy and mass interchangeable. So here's an electron and a positron. It's antiparticle. Mass disappears, and in its place comes energy. Okay, mass is converted into energy. Matter and antimatter annihilate each other and take the form of energy. Okay, so right. So we also need to know one more thing. So we need to know that about quantum and that about relativity. But there's a third thing, which we actually already kind of know. It just needs to be sort of pointed out to us. We might not have thought about this before. And that is that information is physical. Okay, so information is not just this abstract, maybe mathematical or some kind of abstract concept in our minds. Information in a very general sense is something physically real. It must be embodied in some physical form or another. So I'm going to give you a bunch of examples of this to sort of convince you of this fact, because it's important to the basic argument here. Okay, so for example, let's see. So there's Einstein. Einstein's head was full of, thoughts and stuff, right? Thought experiments, ideas, all that kind of stuff. And that's a form of information. And he might put that information, he might scribble that down in some notes like this. These might be notes that describe his ideas about how, you know, gravity bends light around the sun and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so information is clearly physical in this form here. You can see that it's physical. It takes the following physical form. It takes the form of, you know, molecules of ink on a piece of paper. Okay, it takes some physical form like that. Okay, so that information has taken that particular physical form. Okay, so now you might well say, well, what about the ideas themselves in like Einstein's brain, right? I mean, what about that? Okay, so if you think about it, I mean, the brain is composed of a vast number of neurons, and what's particularly important about that collection of neurons is the way that those neurons are interconnected. Okay, so as you are at the ISSYP, your neurons are being rearranged in new and interesting ways. And so as we learn things, as we have ideas, these interconnections are being changed. And when we're thinking things, then it's just certain networks here that are being excited, electrically excited, electrochemical reactions, and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, memories and thoughts and all that stuff at bottom is just some kind of physical process in one's brain, or at least according to present ideas about this sort of thing. Is that okay? You buy that? Okay, excellent. All right. So here's another example of how information is physical. I mean, one obvious way is with computers. Okay, so when a computer represents information, I mean, ultimately it's in the form of binary, zeros and ones. So long strings of zeros and ones are stored in memory, and then they are taken from the memory and processed and so on and so forth. The question is, how are those zeros and ones actually stored and processed in the computer? Is it just some abstract? Does the computer have some mysterious way of manipulating zeros and ones abstractly? or storing them? Well, no, it's a definite physical concrete thing. So for example, the voltage on a capacitor. When the voltage is 5 volts, well, that represents a 1. When the voltage is 0, that represents a 0. Voltage on the capacitor is a physical thing. There's an electric field, there's electrons, there's particles, that sort of thing. Or current, when current is flowing through a transistor, that means it's on, a 1. When current is not flowing, it's off. That represents a 0. So 0 and 1 are represented physically by the flow of electric charge or not, okay? Or particles of light for optical processing and so on. So or magnetic bits or magnetic domains on hard drives and so on and so forth. Any example you think of that involves a computer and processing or storing of information takes some physical form or another. Okay, so So here's another example that's probably the most sort of relevant to what we're going to get to is the internet. Okay, so when you're connected to the internet, downloading stuff. It's pretty clear that information takes a physical form. So here you are connected to the internet. So this is a representation of the internet, or at least part of it. And here's a little node, and you're connected to that node, et cetera, et cetera. So when you send or when you download something, typically, for sure nowadays, that information will be encoded in the form of light, in the form of photons. Big bunches of photons. When there's a bunch of photons, that represents a 1. When there's no photons, that represents a 0. Okay, and so information is sent along fiber optic cables as bunches or no bunches of photons. So it takes that kind of physical form. And so then it travels through the internet, and then it's converted into other physical forms inside your computer, and then other physical forms on your, the pixels on your screen are LCD crystals, which are long molecules oriented this way or this way or whatever, another physical form, and so on. So it's always taking one physical form or another. Okay, so are we convinced that information is physical? Any arguments? Not yet. Okay, we'll come to it. Excellent. Okay, so summary so far, we have from quantum, we know that E equals HF. From relativity, we know that E equals MC squared. And from just basic common sense about the world and all that, we know that information needs to be embodied in one physical form or another. So information is physical. So we've got these three basic facts. Now the next step is to actually combine these facts, which is basically quantum and relativity, plus this kind of a background fact. What are quantum and relativity trying to tell us about the deeper nature of the universe? Okay, so to help answer this question, what we're going to do is we've got this this sphere here, and we are going to ask a very, very important question. This is the question central to this little presentation. The question is, how much information can we cram into this sphere? Okay, knowing that information is physical, and knowing certain properties about the universe, namely quantum and relativity that we've talked about so far. Okay, So let's try to answer this question. Maximum information we can jam into that sphere. So first off, let's agree that information of any kind, at the end of the day, can ultimately be encoded into long strings of zeros and ones. So if I take a picture of something, I can encode that picture into digital elements, and those digital elements are ultimately can be encoded into zeros and ones, and so that picture can be represented as a long string of zeros and ones. Okay, so with that example as our principal example, I think it's probably pretty clear. Are we okay that we can represent information in general as say a long string of zeros and ones? Okay, so we're okay. Okay, super. Okay, so that's information, and then the question is, how much of that kind of information can we jam into that sphere? Okay, so while we think about that, and we think, well, if we didn't realize that information was physical, it might just be kind of a stupid question. Well, I don't know, infinite. Like there'd be, like if information were just some abstract, thing, abstract concept, it doesn't really quite even make sense. But now that we recognize that information must take one physical form or another, for example, on the internet, the photons that are carrying zeros and ones, well, now when we're saying how much information can we cram into that sphere, what we're really saying is how much physical information can we cram in? How can we actually represent it? So. Here's a very simple way to represent information, bits of information, zeros and ones. We can use a photon, one photon to represent one bit of information. It turns out that photons have a peculiar property that are called polarization, which can be thought of as when the photon is moving this way, then it can be either spinning clockwise or it's spinning counterclockwise. Okay, so let's say we'll use clockwise photons to represent a 1 and counterclockwise photons to represent a 0. Okay, so instead of this, this abstract string of zeros and ones being fed into that a little hole inside of this sphere here, what we do is we have this long string of photons. Some polarized left, some polarized right. Okay, and all those photons are entering the sphere, and they are being stored in there. Okay, so so all is well. Okay, so now we need to use the fact that now here's where quantum comes in. Quantum tells us that the energy of each of those photons is Planck's constant h times the frequency. Okay, and we also know that from the basic wave equation that the frequency is related to the speed and the wavelength by f equals c over lambda. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that every photon, every bit of information, a 0 or a 1, that goes into that sphere has an energy cost. Okay, it's going to use up some energy. It's going to involve some energy. It's going to take some energy into that sphere. And the amount of energy is just, the energy cost is hf, which is hc divided by the wavelength. Okay, so what we would like to do is we would like to get as much information in there as possible using the least amount of energy. Okay, putting the least amount of energy in that sphere. Because we'll see when we put too much energy in, it's problematic. We want to try to get as much info in as we can with as little energy as possible. So what we want to do is minimize the amount of energy per photon. Well, if you look at this expression for the energy per photon, well, h, that's a universal constant. C, that's a universal constant. Can't do much about those. Okay, but we can do something about lambda, the wavelength of the photon. So how do we minimize the energy? What do we do to lambda? Make it as big as possible. How big could we make it? This is the interesting question. Just as big as the...
As we wish to be.
Oh, as big as we wish it to be. Actually, no. So there is an upper limit. Okay, so here's our sphere. And the fact is, if we want to put a photon in that sphere, a photon is a wavelength. And it turns out that you actually can't put a photon in the sphere if its wavelength is bigger than about the radius of the sphere. If it's too long of a wavelength, the photon, it just won't go in the sphere. Okay, so the photon wavelength has to be on the order of the radius of the sphere or smaller to actually fit inside the sphere. So there's actually a maximum wavelength that we can use, or in other words, a minimum energy. You can't use zero energy photons. That's crucial to this whole argument. Okay, so the minimum energy that we could use is if we make the wavelength on the order of magnitude of the radius of the sphere. Okay, so then the minimum energy cost would be just hc divided by r, that sort of order of magnitude for each of those photons. And then, so if we're firing in n bits of information, then the total energy, the minimum energy that we would, bring into the sphere with us would be n times that, n h c over r. Okay, you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So now we use, yeah.
Why is it the radius?
As opposed to the diameter?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just a ballpark number. So let me just say, first of all, none of these numbers are exact. So all I'm saying is that if you have a sphere, say with reflective coating inside, and you want to put an electromagnetic, so it's a little bit like this. If you have a drum, a simpler example, a guitar string. A guitar string has various harmonics, right? So it has this harmonic, the fundamental. Or this, the first harmonic, second harmonic. So when you pluck a guitar string, you can excite these various harmonics. When you take a drum, it's the surface of a drum, if you pound the drum, say right in the center, you will excite the fundamental, which is just the whole membrane going back and forth. You could also put, a ruler across it like that, and just hit this side down, then this side would go down, this side would go up, and you would have this kind of motion with a known in between, and so on. So you can get more complicated modes
on the surface of a drum, the same thing inside a sphere. So inside a sphere, you can have, instead of say, waves in the guitar string or waves on a membrane of a drum, you can have electromagnetic waves inside that sphere. And the lowest frequency of electromagnetic wave, well, it's hard to draw, I don't know exactly what the shape of the electromagnetic field is, but its wavelength is on the order of magnitude of the size of the sphere. I don't remember what it is. It's something like, the wavelength is 0.42768 times r. And we don't care about numbers like this. Okay, so we're just saying, just approximately, it gives us this sort of order of magnitude or general feeling for the size is involved. Okay, so we're not trying to be exact. Okay, so then we say, okay, so we've used quantum so far, and we've got this expression for the minimum energy accompanying n bits. And then we use relativity, well, E equals mc squared, and that energy that we've put in there, as far as the effects on space-time and so forth and so on, and gravity and all that is concerned, it's the same as having a gravitating mass. Okay, or for n bits, that's essentially this. Okay, so that's that. So we basically just divided this by c squared. Okay, so when we put n bits of information in that spherical region of space, then effectively it's the same thing as putting this much mass into that region of space. Okay, at least that much mass, if not more. Okay, so this is a minimum amount of mass that corresponds to. Okay, so ultimately our question of maximum information inside that sphere boils down to the question of is there a maximum n? Okay, so, well, is there a maximum n? So that's the question. What do you say?
Yes.
Why?
Because if you put too much mass in one area, it will collapse.
And a black hole will form, right, something like that. Okay, so the relationship between the mass and the size of the region is given by Schwarzschild's formula here, which Michael will talk about more in the second week. So for a black hole, okay, so that is the limit at which you
can't cram any more information in there without actually increasing the size of the region. So let me just clarify the question. The question is, for a sphere of given surface area, okay, a region of space of given surface area, we want to jam in more and more information. And what we find is if we put in that much information, if we put in enough information, a black hole will form. And then if we put in more information, a black hole, we can throw more stuff in. We can fire in more photons. But then what will happen is the mass of the black hole will increase and its size will necessarily increase. So for the given size, the given surface area that we started with, there is a maximum. And beyond that, a black hole exists. Okay, so that's it. So at the end of the day, you can put these equations together in a very simple way, which I'll leave as an exercise for you to do. At the end of the day, the maximum information you can fit in is the area of the sphere divided by 4 times the Planck area. Okay, don't worry about the factor of 4. It's basically the area of the sphere measured in units of Planck area. So so a Planck length, as Clara mentioned yesterday, is a fundamental length unit in our universe, which has to do with gravity gravity, special relativity, and quantum. Okay, so. The fundamental constants that we have, the basic fundamental constants. So G, H, and C. So any theory that we're going to be talking about here, any theory of quantum gravity, would certainly involve a Planck's constant, which is H. It would certainly involve Newton's constant, G, associated with gravity, and it would certainly involve the speed of light. Okay, and so those three constants can be combined together in a unique way to give a length scale. Okay, and so it turns out that that the amount of information is limited. The number of bits of information is basically the area of the sphere divided by a Planck area. Okay, so the area of the sphere measured in Planck units. Okay, so this is extremely bizarre. because, first of all, the maximum information is finite. Okay, first of all, one would have thought, if one didn't realize that information is physical, one would have thought, well, I can stick in any amount of information I want in there. Okay, but this is actually, it's actually finite. Okay, the amount of information is actually quite large. I'll leave it as an exercise for you to work out, because we're starting a bit late here, but work it out. Work out how much information in, say, a sphere whose surface area is 1 square meter, how much information could we put in there now with our latest technology for hard drives, for example. Suppose we use the latest hard drive technology and jam it into a room whose surface area is 1 square meter. How much information does that correspond to? And how much information does this maximum amount of information correspond to? And you'll find that it's huge numbers of orders of magnitude, okay, which means that we are nowhere near the maximum information density possible in our universe. Okay, so anyways, I don't want to go down that road. Okay, so second thing is it depends on the area and not on the volume. Okay, this is extremely bizarre. Okay, so one would imagine that here I've got some region of space, and I'm asking, what is the maximum amount of information I could jam into that volume of space? One would imagine, sort of commonsensically, that the amount would depend upon the volume of the region. If you double the volume, you've doubled the amount of information you can cram in there. But no, it seems to depend only on the surface area of the region and not on the volume. Yeah. Okay, first of all of this stuff is sort of thought about in the context of a round surface, like of a ball. So if you were, if you took that ball and you squished it down, then my sense is all bets are off, and the amount of information that you could cram in there is probably less than the surface area. I don't know. Or is that not right? Okay. Oh, so if I have a really flat ball like that, I can still put in that. Right. But isn't there, there's this hoop conjecture thing, right, with black holes and that. And if you have, I don't know.
Yeah, you know what the
Yeah, that makes sense. Yep. So what you can do is you can take those three formulas that were written down, so E equals MC squared and H equals E equals HF. And the Schwarzschild expression for the mass of a black hole of radius r, just take those three and basically just stare at them and plug them in into each other in a way that makes sense, in a common sense sort of way. So that's for you to figure out tonight. So if you do work it out, you will find that, in fact, it is proportional to area. Yeah, so what I've tried to do is just state kind of the rough argument, but it's your job to put those together and actually derive that formula. Yeah. Yeah, that is fundamentally weird. Okay, so not only, yeah, I see. So not only basically that, not only saying the weirdness of, well, if it's a volume here, if I double the volume, if I put two volumes next to each other, like that's, the, like, it's saying this, which is just simply freaky. If I have a, let's make it a box instead of a sphere here. So here I got some volume here, right? If I double the volume, surely the maximum amount of information I can fit in here is now double. Well, that's not true. It won't double. The surface area has not doubled because this is overlapped here. The surface area has not doubled. That, okay, so if you move the two boxes apart, then you have, yeah, well, then it's just a different situation, right? Yeah, but there's this, but there are effects with gravity that, so if I have these two boxes separate here, okay, and so I say, well, okay, maximum information I can stick in here is basically a black hole. Maximum information here I can stick in here is a black hole. But when I bring these together, there are effects between the two that are, like I think it's a non-linear effect to do with gravity. Is it? Yeah, it is pretty deep. Okay. Okay. So here is oh, I see Julie has come in. We should probably well, okay. We can go till 5 though, right? Because you're gonna do the snow thing at 5, right? Sure? Okay, super. All right. So some physicists feel that this is like way cool. That maybe this this line of reasoning, a little bit more sophisticated than what we went through here, but that this line of reasoning leads to, you know, this kind of an idea, and maybe this is actually a hint. Maybe this is a very, very deep hint as to the ultimate nature of reality. Or maybe it's not, right? But it's certainly something worth thinking about, at least many physicists feel that way. Okay, so here we've got this sphere again. Let me just sort of emphasize what the result is. The maximum information we can fit inside that sphere is the surface area of the sphere measured in units of Planck area. Okay, so what that means is take that sphere and divide it up into a whole bunch of Planck areas here. Okay, Planck areas are the little triangles, and for every four, so that's a Planck area is that little red guy, and for every four Planck areas, which is the blue triangle there, I can basically stick one bit of information in that sphere. Okay, so this is really bizarre. So if I have a volume like this, a spherical volume, and I'm feeding like information in the form of photons or whatever, that other stuff, and I'm filling the volume with information in some way, the maximum information I can jam in there is equivalent to totally ignoring the volume inside and simply having taken that sphere, divided it up into little Planck areas and painted zeros and ones on the surface of that sphere. Okay? And so when I increase the size of the region, you know, the amount of information I fit in there, can fit in there, the max, doesn't depend upon the change in volume, which grows faster than the surface area, but just in terms of, but just depends on the surface area. Yeah.
Same bits that computers use?
Yes.
So you still have one bit, it's still in very much information. So most of the power of 7, it's going to be less than that for somebody who wants to sort of picture or something. So, I mean, you have to put it in, like you get the 10th to the power of 70, but if you can only, if that's only in bits, can't do very much per bit. That's what I'm saying. So if you want to actually store something useful, it's going to take quite a few of those bits. So is it, like, have they looked at that? Like,
are you saying that there may be more efficient ways of coding information rather than using strings of zeros and ones?
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying to review that limits the total of their useful information, because one bit isn't very much. If you have something that takes 1,000 bits
right to
store, then that's but if you let's say you decrease that to 10 to 6 bits, So if you're looking at the limit of information, you have to look at the way you can actually store it. Like if you don't have the constraints, you store it.
But I think that ultimately all information can be reduced to you know, a string of zeros and ones. And if you try to do it any other way, it would essentially amount to the same thing.
It's not enough for us to store enough information.
How come?
No. I'm saying 10 to the 70 is not really big.
It's huge.
No, I know it's huge.
It's huge in the sense that. Okay, sorry.
Well, we're talking bits. I'm saying, how come they don't put in something useful like how many pictures or how many words of the document or something?
I can convert it to that. So I can say, suppose I have 10 to the 10 bits or something. I can then say one digital picture is worth 10 to the 7 bits. And so just divide and say that, well, that's 1,000 pictures.
Like, I'm not saying it's not a large number, but I'm saying we actually put it into something that you would actually store. You still decrease that number, so it's not as big as what it seems. It's a little bit, like, it's still huge, but it's smaller.
But I think no matter what measure of information you use, it's going to be, like, freaky big.
Yeah.
Like it's a huge amount of information. Like we're nowhere near achieving that kind of information density.
So have they done it with the human brain?
Human brain is like negligible. Like if you were to like figure out the the surface area of the head and divide by Planck units, like way more. The information is negligible.
The amount of human information you can store in your brain is of the order of a gigabyte, right? So that's 10 to the 9. And then the volume of your head in Planck units would be somewhere in the order of 10 to the 70. So there's still a factor of 10 to the 60 more information. I mean, that's 10 to the 60 is ridiculously hard. I mean, it's so difficult to even visualize how big that number is. I don't know anything to compare. I mean, like even like the smallest. Like a quark is like what, 10 to the minus 15 meters, so that's 15 orders of magnitude, and from us, right? And even the universe, the visible universe, is I don't know. It's more I mean, still like there's maybe a difference of like another 15 orders of magnitude. So you're going out. That's 30 orders of magnitude. So 60 orders of magnitude is. So 30 orders of magnitude is the biggest thing in the universe to the smallest thing that we know. So it's
yeah, that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
Another way to think about it is, I mean, the brain, okay, it's neurons, right? How big is a neuron? A neuron is pretty big. A neuron you can see with a microscope, right? A regular microscope is huge. If you were to go, if you were to store information, not in terms of neurons and their interconnections, but in terms of individual electrons. Electrons, say, in a magnetic field can be spinning, say, this way or that way. That's a zero, that's a one kind of thing. And suppose these are all entangled or whatever. There's you're storing information that way. Now you're talking about information density at the scale of like electrons. So as Sean is saying, like femtometers, let's say that kind of scale. So you could make something with a way more information density than human brain out of elementary particles. And that's still nowhere near what we're talking about here with this holographic map. Maps and down.
Yeah. Are we sticking strictly to like static information, like information that could change? Because when you gave an example about Einstein's brain, the connections don't have the information that he later produced.
Okay, so over time it changed. And then
yeah, but it's the connection that if you this type of information corresponds to memory.
Yeah. So
you go on one day.
So I'm just talking about the present state past state or at some time the sometime state of Einstein's brain.
All right.
Okay. So at some point in time, his brain was in a certain state, and we can look at some measure of complexity of the connections or how that information is stored in the interconnections and so on, and sort of quantify that as
how much information is in there. We could do that, and then at a later time, you know, that would simply change. Just the connections would change. It would just be a different state, but the amount of information would basically be the same. I mean, for all practical purposes, it would essentially be the same.
I think you're asking a good question, because even in the sort of proper formulation of this, typically done in a static type, static, but more or less static.
Because it depends on
because of what you're saying, like if information is changing, then you need more information to say how much information is changing. But it's more complicated, but I think that at the end of the day, really the bulk of the argument is more, take a particular instance, how much information can I fit? At a later instance, I can fit this much information still. And like the transition between the two is not necessarily all that interesting.
Yeah. I have a question. Because the amount of information is proportional to area, does it mean if we make very complicated shapes with fractal areas that we can store really big amount of information in a small volume, if it has a very complicated surface?
Okay. That's an interesting question.
Okay, so fractal areas. So
doesn't that imply that the area is only the area? Was that really stored on the surface?
Right. So there's some sense in which that's implied, right? But how that's physically realized depends upon. Well, what does it depend upon, John? Okay. So the idea is that there seems to be some implication that the information is stored on the surface, and whether or not that's sort of realized is depends on how you physically realize that. So, for example, in string theory, there's a relation. A relationship has been more or less established between certain theories in one dimension, a different theory in another dimension, another number of dimensions. And there's been an equivalence established between those two. So for example, the implication here, or the connection with what we're talking about here, is there's a certain sense in which what's going on inside this room, okay, we're talking about fundamentally elementary particles moving around on trajectories or whatever, or quantum is a little more complicated and so on. We're talking about things happening in the volume. The implications of this kind of thought process here, or thought experiment, is that whatever is going on in this room, no matter how complicated it is, no matter how many people are jammed in here, no matter what's happening, the physics of that could be described by an equivalent, but very near kind of theory living just on the surface, a very different theory living just on the surface of this room. So you could have, instead of particles zipping around inside this volume, you could have other things like fields on the surface. And their behavior would exactly encode everything that's going on inside this room. So mathematically, they're equivalent. You have a mathematical theory describing what's happening in this three-dimensional room, and that's mathematically equivalent to something that just, a reality that just lives on the surface. And so, which is kind of freaky. What it's basically telling you fundamentally, I think, is that the amount of information that can be put inside some region, or the total amount of information that can be used to describe what's happening in this room in at any instant of time, is a lot less than we thought before this. Okay, so one would imagine that, okay, well, there's a whole heck of a lot of information that can be stored in this room. Every single elementary particle can be in X, you have to specify its X, Y, Z position, and its velocity and all that stuff. Like, that's a huge amount of information. But it turns out that the maximum amount of information possible is actually quite a bit less than that. It could be described just by positions of particles essentially on the surface only, which is really, really freaky.
Do you think that's a fair characterization?
I think going back to some of the questions that were asked, like, I think the thing that's weird is, I mean, in the way that you set it up, it's a very simple minor thing. You've got a grid, two-dimensional grid on the outside, on the surface, and you have a grid on the inside. And you'd expect that the grid, you know, you expect that if you have, you know, if you put this thing into a grid, this D grid, that you'd be able to, the amount of information you'd cram, just be ones and zeros on the grid. But instead, what you find is you can describe everything that happens using a grid that lives only on the surface. And so you're asking questions like, what if you make the grid more complicated? Can you store more information? I think the answer is just, well, if you make the grid on the outside more complicated, you can equally well make the grid on the inside more complicated. The difference is the scaling of the volume to the area, it's the extra dimension. And so, you know, you could have really, really complicated theories on the outside. It's not so strange to imagine a two-dimensional theory describing a three-dimensional world. But it's when each of those theories are restricted by various rules. That's kind of weird. You didn't describe that properly. But when you limit yourselves to a certain complexity on the surface and on the material, and what you find is that it's the surface stuff that's important. You see what I'm getting at? Maybe I'm not saying this properly. But what really the whole Galois principle is, and remember, this is just a principle. Nobody is saying this is known for sure that the universe is like this. We're far away from being able to test the implications of this. But what it's saying is that if this is true, then we're used to thinking of our world as being three-dimensional, right? But it may be that the reason why we're used to that is just because we would happen to live very far from this upper bound. And we live in a very special sort of world where things look three-dimensional. But if we grew up somewhere very different, where there was all kinds of information, we're close to them, we might instead see the world as being two-dimensional. And we'd have a description of that would be very different from the one that we know. Now, both of those descriptions are supposed to be equivalent somehow. They're describing the same thing. But that, to me, is like the what's going on. But there's a couple more questions.
Yeah. Is there like some physical reality shapes that maximize the area for a given volume?
Sphere.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a variational solve work.
Or are you thinking you're thinking the reverse?
Yeah.
So the surface area minimizes the volume for a given volume. Sorry, it's the minimum area for a given volume. So what we would be looking for is the maximum area.
Maximum area for a given volume.
Yeah. So the reverse of that is like, well, I mean, you know, some fractal surface or something.
Like,
I mean, I don't think there would be a.
Well,
it's not obviously that there would even be a maximum.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you entertain the idea of fractal surfaces, you could just start just cranking that up.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Because like mathematics, you can get like infinite surface area for a finite volume.
Yes.
That's obviously impossible in reality.
And I'm not sure that. Well, I'm not sure that sort of idea respects. Respects the ideas of this holographic bound, this information bound. Like I think, I think all of this is to be taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of a very rough, arm waving kind of an argument, and it leads to a result which is very very thought provoking, very very strange, right? But what is required is a really concrete, detailed mathematical realization of this. For example, in string theory or in loop quantum gravity, do we see a concrete realization of this holographic principle or this holographic conjecture coming out? And then you could ask more detailed questions about what happens when you change the shape of the surface to maybe from smooth to fractal effect. And then have a sensible way of answering those questions. And right now, questions like that are, I just think, my sense is that they're just sort of outside the framework or the scope of this very, very rough, arm-wavy, rule-of-thumb kind of thought experiment.
Because, like, you couldn't, even if you did fractals, you couldn't continue the fractal past, like, the Planck length or Planck area.
Yeah, I don't know what you can continue past. We don't know anything about the Planck area. I mean, there's this sense that at that scale, we don't know. But, yeah, one would expect weird things to happen, or at least our common sense understanding of things to break down in some way. And maybe that means that, no, we can't extend the fractal beyond that, or maybe it means that it limits the shapes that we can call complementary shapes and be bifurcated and so on. I don't know. So we do have to go, and I just wanted to show you one thing just very, very quickly before we actually go. And Sean, please stay. So and the reason I want to show you this is because on Saturday we're actually going to be making holograms. So I wanted to actually make the connection here with why is the title of this thing World of the Hologram? Okay, so this is what a hologram looks like. A hologram is basically just an interference pattern. We'll talk about how the holograms are constructed as an interference between the original laser beam and a reflection from the object you're making the hologram of. But at the end of the day, a hologram is just an interference pattern. And then, but if you illuminate that with laser light, what you find is that if you look at it, say, from one angle over here, you see the guy's face, that side of the guy's face. If you look at it from the other angle, you see the other side of the guy's face. So there's a sense in which looking at this thing, if I turn my head this way and that way, I see different sides of this person's face. And so while the surface containing that information is just two-dimensional, there clearly is some a definite sense in which three-dimensional information is contained in that two-dimensional surface. In very much the same way as we were saying, we have this information in this room, three-dimensional information particles zipping around and so on and so forth, and there may be a mathematically equivalent way to describe all of that, but just in terms of things just living on the surface. And so the this or as Sean was saying here, stuff just painted on the surface here is equivalent. The information on the surface is equivalent to represent all of the information inside a three-dimensional volume. And so that's really quite freaky. So in a certain sense, it's kind of like this. This is kind of like a cartoony way of looking at this. So here's this person here who's living in this two-dimensional world. So as Sean was saying, maybe close to the to this holographic band, for us here, who's actually living in some sense in a two-dimensional world, but has the illusion that it's a three-dimensional world. Okay, so this is like the 2D hologram, is this picture here, and the 3D illusion is like that. So Bekenstein here, there's a quote from him in the paper that these pictures were in. So our everyday perceptions of the world as three-dimensional is either a profound illusion or merely one of two alternative ways of viewing reality, which is just really, really, really weird, thought-provoking, bizarre. So should we take maybe one or two more questions and then quit, or should we take zero more questions and then quit? Okay.
I'm not sure if anyone saw this. If you have a question that didn't get answered, there's post-it notes. You can write your question on here, and then Richard can take a few minutes to answer your question. And there's more post-it notes here. So if you have questions, you can always, during the breaks, whatever, you can come to grab a piece of paper. And obviously, someone's already written a question, so we can answer them. Okay? So I'm just going to be talking to you for a few minutes about the snow lab trip.